Are you dealing with a broken heart or broken dreams or a broken leg? Or perhaps you're struggling with a case of terminal arrogance, agoraphobia, adultery, too little ambition? Reaching for a good book might be just what the doctor ordered. Have you heard of bibliotherapy? This is the premise there's a whole archive of fictional stories that we can learn from to inform our lives and even fix some of our ailments with. Tolstoy for a toothache, who would have thought? Self-described bibliotherapists Ella Bertou and Susan Eldekin have put together a rather thrilling compendium, I have to say, of cure-alls called The Novel Cure, an A to Z of literary remedies. Fantastic to just pick up at your leisure and read. And they join me on the line from the UK. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hey, Susan, explain this wonderful idea and its origins. What's the approach of bibliotherapy?
Well, it all began when Ella and I met at university some 25 years ago now, and we started giving one another books, not just for the pleasure of the reading experience, we were both studying English, but to cheer each other up and to give each other a boost or to give each other a gentle kick up the backside when one of us was swaying a little bit from the path of straight and narrow. So we kind of did it instinctively with each other, and it grew from there. We started to give novels to friends and family with the same sort of idea behind it. And in 2008, we set up a bibliotherapy service through a fantastic organisation in London called the School of Life, and started seeing clients and prescribing, as we started to call it, books for various ailments and conditions of the spirit. And the book is a gathering together of the best of those books, really, that is kind of encyclopedia of books which can have a fantastic impact on your life. They're books which help you to see the world in a new way or see yourself in a new way or can, you know, can change the course of one's life.
So you've actually made bibliotherapy your day jobs.
Yeah, amazingly, we have.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Well, Ella, what were you both prescribing, if I can put it that way, to each other in your 20s when you're at university or your late teens? What sort of angsts and what sort of literary remedies did you give each other?
Well, at that point, Suze was on the path to becoming an author, which she has succeeded, obviously, in doing. But she did occasionally have wobblies, thinking it was all too agonising and traumatic. So I prescribed her a fantastic book called Archie and Mehita Bell, which is a book of poems which becomes a novel about a cockroach who has the soul of the poet who jumps on the typewriter keys in the office of this New York writer in order to write his poetry because he's so desperate to write his poetry. And I said to Suze, well, if the cockroach can do it, then so can you. So that's what I was recommending to her. And Suze was recommending to me books to help me on my path to become an artist because I was very keen on painting and on literature, and I wasn't quite sure if I'd be able to combine the two. And she very wonderfully prescribed me a brilliant book by Italo Calvino called Cosmic Comics.
Oh, yes.
Which wonderful. I love.
Yeah. And why was that therapeutic?
Because it showed me that I could paint pictures based on literature that I loved. And I have spent the next 20 years, as well as reading, I've based a lot of my actual paintings on books that I've read. And that was the first one that I managed to do that with. So that was quite a revelation to me at the time.
And of relevance, we'll get to the premise a little bit more closely in a tick, but of relevance is there's a whole category here. I mean, there's hundreds of offerings in this compendium, but one of them is low self-esteem, and you've got a whole lot of offerings there too. Where do you start with low self-esteem?
Well, we often have a sort of three-prong approach to something, or a two-prong approach. This is for low self-esteem, we prescribe Rebecca as a kind of, by Daphne du Maurier, as a kind of cautionary tale, really, of what not to do and how to make things worse, which is to constantly undermine yourself, as the narrator of Rebecca does, if you remember. And
yes,
she's always comparing herself to the first missus of the household, and she always comes off terribly. So it kind of makes you blush to read it if you're inclined to do that yourself and realise how self-destructive that is.
So you are Rebecca in that household with, as the second Mrs. De Winter and the tough household, Mrs. Danvers,
yeah,
had her affiliation with the first wife, not Rebecca.
Yeah, and of course it turns out, well, we shouldn't give too much away, but it turns out that she's doing this to herself, really. And there's a lovely alternative cure, which is A Kestrel for a Knave by Barry Hines, which is the book that became the film of Kes. I don't know whether that reached Australia, yes, but it was a big film here, okay, in the 60s. And that's a lovely portrayal of a boy from a mining town in the north of England, very socially deprived. He doesn't get a lot of love and support and encouragement from his family or his peers at school. And he finds a kestrel, he looks after it. And there's a lovely line in it which we kind of honed in on, which is that the kestrel, this incredible wild creature, just seems to be proud of itself, is what he says. And it's a beautiful and very sad, actually, evocation of somebody who comes close to finding self-respect himself through a wild creature.
What's beautiful about this is that you're not just helping those with existential angst or frustrations or soul-searching. There are healing opportunities for physical illness as well. And, I mean, one example is what to do if you've lost a limb or broken a leg.
Exactly.
And what are you offering there, Ella?
We have Cleave by your very own Australian Nikki Gammell, which is a book that plays on the double meaning of the word cleaved. So it's about both cleaving to and cleaving away from things. And it's about the way that people cleave together in the same way that we say a bone can cleave back together. So it's a very kind of metaphorical approach to the cure of healing the broken leg. But our message is that it's a brilliant book to be lying around in a plaster cast with, as well as the fact that it will help you to knit yourself together again, both physically and emotionally.
Mm. Susan, in the case of another affliction that you've got in the collection, fear of commitment, it's not just the text, it's not just the content of a book that you're offering, but it's actually the act of reading that becomes the therapeutic act in this case. Can you explain that for us?
Well, some of the books in here work on the base on the level of language and rhythm, and you know, whether it's a book that rouses you into action or whether it's a book that keeps you, sort of pacifies you. And the way this one works, it's an amazing book by a Portuguese writer called José Saramago called Blindness. And Saramago writes in a very distinctive style, which is a little bit stream of consciousness, but that kind of doesn't really explain what he does with it. It's his sentences go on and on. There's often no full stop for a while. There's commas instead of full stops. And once you have begun a sentence by Saramago, you kind of are in there for the long haul. You have to commit to it because you just get swept through, and it's very easy just to read the book in one or two sittings, actually. It's an amazing rollercoaster ride. It's a book that's very, very gripping because of its style. So we play with the idea of commitment, learning to commit through Saramago's style, but there's also...
Through an impossible prose. Some might say, though, that life is too short, Susan, for impossible prose.
Well, everybody has different tastes, you know, so what we have tried to do in this book is include some books which are more literary and more challenging, some books which are classics and well-loved by many people, but here's a way to read it in a different way, and some contemporary books and some books from other countries that you might not have come across, and we've really tried to kind of open our arms very wide to embrace what's out there and bring it together.
But his book...
Yeah, and we want people to jump into the unknown as much as possible with these books and find new ways of enjoying them, even if they initially find them a little bit off-putting.
But it's the content of Jose's book that is also relevant here. It's actually a really terrifying story of blindness, of an entire community being essentially going blind, and a husband and a wife end up in an asylum together.
It is terrifying and very intense as a read, but what comes out of the book that's so beautiful is their commitment to each other. So we really think that it's a wonderful book to read to make you feel very romantic and as if it really is worth pledging your love to one person forever. So it's actually a very romantic, beautiful book.
My guests this morning on Life Matters are Ella Badtu and Susan Eldekin, and they've written a delicious compendium, an A to Z of literary remedies called The Novel Cure. And we're speaking to them on the line from London. Two Little Sex. Why are you prescribing me nuns and monks?
Ella's responsible for that one. I'm going to hand over to her.
Ella. What are you doing to me?
Well, those monks and nuns are so desperate for sex that they start getting together for some very strange rituals. Have you read the book?
No, I haven't.
Thousand Autumns of Jacob Desert.
Tell me why one should read the book.
Because it makes you realize that you're a lot better off than those people, for one thing. And actually, also, the intensity of the nuns and monks' desire for each other makes it a very erotic read. So if you are suffering from too little sex and you read this book, you're quite likely to feel completely impelled to go and do something about it.
Just describe it, because it's a really evocative image that David Mitchell creates in that book of an island off Japan at the turn of the 19th century, I think, and this community of nuns and monks.
Yes, it's a very strange book, to be honest, with this very strange community, which is never really explained, and it's very enigmatic and intriguing. And the nuns are completely separate from the monks, but they do have these rituals once a month when they get together and perform sexual rituals. And meanwhile, there's this man that's come over from Holland who is a clerk, and he's trying to sort out some mathematical problems for the colony, and he gets involved with one of the nuns, and it's very complicated, but it becomes an amazing whodunit. It's actually a very gripping and quite breathtaking book, but at the heart of it is this very strange community, which I would love to know more about, because it's a complete mystery.
Yes, well, if anyone's into some erotic fiction, David Mitchell's Nuns and Monks, no, The Thousand Autumns of, is it Jacob Desert?
Yes.
When you're working therapeutically, I mean, we're laughing now, but you're working obviously in a very profound way with people, Susan, with your clients now. What sort of transformations have you both seen in these offerings that you're giving people?
Well, some of the more serious ailments are ones which we very much wanted to talk about and test out on people with those ailments, things like despair and depression, and they're not a laughing matter. And we wanted very much to, reach out to people with those very serious ailments, because this is where literature really can make a difference, I think. And we discovered something which may be perhaps a little surprising, which is that when people are very depressed, they don't really want a kind of light pick-me-up, which is going to jolly them along and say, come on, the sun's shining outside. That's more for when you're just feeling a little bit blue. But for serious depression, actually what seems to be helpful is books which are about characters who are also seriously depressed and who can hold your hand in that dark place, and you can know that you're not the only one who's been there, and it's not just you going crazy. So, for that reason, we have books like The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath and The Unbearable Lightness of Being by Kundera. And so, sometimes it's the antidote you're prescribing, but sometimes it's the very thing itself.
It's a delicate tango, isn't it? And I'm wondering how this all sits in the kind of contemporary medical paradigm within which we think about depression. And certainly, in broadcasting about these themes over the years, sometimes certain therapies are actually quite risky for people with profound depression, because there's just too much internalisation going on in a therapeutic process, and sometimes you need to actually distract yourself from that. What's the tension there that you're walking?
Well, we find that it's normally very interesting to talk to the patient, the client, in depth and discover if they're really more keen on getting a kind of cure which is all about escapism, or if they really do want to delve deeper into the reasons for their depression. And when we prescribe our books to them, we normally give two or three books at the same time. So there might be one which is more light and escapist and one which is really going to help them explore their feelings. And the client will normally self-medicate very effectively. So if they are finding that the book they're reading is too much and too heavy, then they'll put it down and come back to it later. So that's one of the joys of using fiction and literature therapeutically rather than other more medical approaches, that it's a method that the client can very much use in the way that they want to use it.
Yeah, what's remarkable is we have this wonderful historical resource, you know, centuries and centuries of fictional
exactly.
stories to inform
exactly.
our lives.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is something which I think is really underused and undervalued at the moment in this day and age. I think we both feel really strongly that when people are reading yesterday's big bestseller, that means that, you know, they're not going to be reading, I don't know, a book from 20 years ago, such as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or, you know, The Master and Margarita, which actually is an incredibly powerful and potentially transformative book.
Let's weave in a couple more examples before I let you go into your nighttime. This is an A to Z. Let's start at A. Arrogance, and you go to the classic tale that so many of us would, that tension between Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice. Tell us.
Well, you're the one most.
I know many who are obsessed with Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah, no, well, it's a lovely story, and I love the Bridget Jones play with the whole idea as well. I mean, it is seen to be one of the biggest crimes in literature, I think, arrogance. I mean, there's Mr. Darcy, who is the most eligible man in, you know, for 25-mile radius, which is pretty much the same as saying within the entire country. Mrs. Bennet has five daughters, and she still thinks he's, you know, not worth talking to because of the way he's behaved. So a very, very serious element in literature, and Elizabeth deals with it so beautifully, with great wit, and she teases him, she mocks him, she insults him to his face, and he finally, of course, realises that she's doing him a great service. So one would hope that that message might get through to somebody suffering from a similar problem.
That we can all be like Elizabeth, but you also prescribe James McCain's Mildred Pierce and Elizabeth Taylor's Angel as two examples of what not to be.
Yeah, they're cautionary tales in a way, but yes, they're people who are so thick-skinned in their arrogant self-belief that they don't even notice anybody around them finding them a problem at all. So
these are two monstrous daughters, Angel and Vader.
That's right.
Yeah. And finally, and I don't know whether it's fair, Man Flu.
It's so difficult.
What way do you think it's not fair?
I just don't know whether it's fair. Don't boys get sick too?
Not when it's Man Flu. That isn't a category of its own. And they deserve Les Miserables, which is a beautiful, brilliant book. And it is the perfect cure because they can come back to it again and again.
It is actually a gift at the end of the day, isn't it? I mean, yeah, we do give them a bit of a hard time for getting man flu when mysteriously no girls seem to get it. But actually, what a gift to be given Les Miserables because it's one of those forgotten masterpieces.
Two volumes.
And also we do have Duvet Days, which is a bit more aimed at women too, so that's kind of our equivalent. There we have the 10 best novels to read on a duvet day when you're feeling tired and emotional and you need some comfort. So we've got a list of books for that, which is a kind of echo for the man flu for the women.
And so much more besides selfishness, pessimism, hiccups, broken hearts, it's all in there, and it's been delightful to have you on the show this morning. Thanks so much for staying up for us.
Thank you very much.
It's been great fun. Oh,
what do you reckon? Susan Eldekin and Ella Bedtu, both work as bibliotherapists in the UK. Their book is The Novel Cure. It's published in Australia by text. Sorry, I disappeared there for a tick. And look, I've popped up on the Facebook page. What novels have made a big difference to how you've navigated difficulties in your life? What literary remedies would you prescribe for what ailments? Let us know. Tell us some of those novels that have made a real difference to you in your life. Siobhan O'Dwyer tweets, my favourite sort of therapy, bibliotherapy. Yes, indeed.